5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. I'm your host, Crimeaholly. I do not have any case updates for you guys today, but I do, however, want to just give a bit of a warning about today's case. Today's case talks quite a bit about sexual activities between consenting adults. This episode may not be one that you want to listen to with your little young kiddos around. I do not go into any like crazy heavy details, but little ears always seem to pick up on stuff and then they ask questions. So to save yourself some potential tough questions that you're going to have to answer that you're not quite ready to answer, if you have little ones around, you may just want to pop in some headphones or save this episode to listen to later. All right, so with that little warning out of the way, let's get into today's case. Today's case is on the murder of Army Major David Shannon. David Shannon was born and raised in Langdon, North Dakota, which Langdon is a small town located in Cavalier County, which is less than 20 minutes from the Canadian border. Growing up, David was a very quiet and shy kid. He was never one to have a ton of friends. He didn't play any sports, and he just kind of kept to himself. He never dated anyone, and his sister described him as being introspective. And though David was shy and closed off with many people, he was for sure certain of one thing about his life, even as a child. David would tell his mother that when he grew up, he was going to be an army man. And this dream started when he was just about 6 or 7 years old, and he held strong with those goals, and eventually he followed through. At the age of 19, David was enlisted, and he was then stationed in upstate New York. It was in New York that he would meet a young woman by the name of Joan. When they met, they hit it off really well. Joan was very drawn to David because of how kind and sweet he was. But the thing that she loved most about David was that he always treated her with the utmost respect. This was something, unfortunately and very sadly, that Joan was not used to. Joan did not have the best upbringing, and at the age of 12, she was sexually abused. Eventually, she was then abandoned by her parents, and she met her first husband who was also abusive towards her. At the age of 18, Joan was married to that abusive man, and she had a daughter named Daisy. And then not long after Daisy came a second daughter named Elizabeth. Not too long after the birth of Elizabeth, Joan found herself single with two children and absolutely no way to provide for them. So she got a job working at a topless bar. From there, she was used and abused by men. She constantly found herself in one bad relationship after another. The men that she dated were only after one thing. And so when she met David, it was like a breath of fresh air. Joan describes how David always treated her like she had value and like she was an equal to him. He was loving and protective of her, but not in that controlling sense that she had been used to with her first husband. David was her knight in shining armor. After dating for about a year, it was Joan who actually asked David to marry her. He obviously said yes, and the two got married in a small North Dakota church surrounded by all of David's family. His family was very happy for him, and they welcomed Joan with open arms. They were pleased that the shy and quiet David had finally found his perfect match. It was very obvious that Joan loved David. She was very attentive to his needs. She did whatever she could to make him happy, and she fit in really well with his family. The two had really completed each other. On the day that they got married, David not only became a husband, but he became a father as well. He loved Joan's daughters as much as he loved Joan, and he was an incredible father to those girls who were at this point 6 and 4 years old. They were a happy family. Of course, like any other relationship, David and Joan did have their fights, but they were never anything crazy explosive. Eventually, their family of four became a family of six when Joan gave birth to two boys. Being a military family, that meant that they moved often. And in the year 2000, David and his family moved south when he got transferred to Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Now, as I mentioned earlier, being a soldier was always what David wanted to be. And while he served in the military, he loved wearing that uniform with every fiber of his being. He was proud of the work that he did. He worked hard and had become an officer, and he earned the rank of major with another promotion on the horizon. By the time that the Shannon family began settling into their new home in Fayetteville, Joan's two older daughters were now teenagers. The older they got, the tougher they became. Obviously, we know that teenagers typically go through some period at one point or another where they are rebellious, they don't listen, they go against the grain. But Daisy and Elizabeth were really out of hand and really out of control. They fought constantly with David and did not like the rules that he put in place. They didn't want to listen, they didn't want to behave, they didn't want to follow rules. They just wanted to live life however they felt was necessary. According to an Oxygen.com article in Fayetteville, the girls quickly gained a reputation for throwing big parties after school while their parents were still at work. And it is said that Joan and David did everything that they could to try and set these girls back on the right track, but no amount of effort had the girls wanting to conform. Daisy was pregnant by the age of 17, and Elizabeth was kicked out of school at 15 years old for getting into fights. Despite the troubles with the girls, the Shannons were settling into their new home and new routines in Fayetteville. They were making friends, work was thriving for David, and from the outside looking in, all seemed to be going fairly well, despite the troubled teens. But everything would change, and secrets would be revealed on a late summer night.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
On the night of July 22, 2002, David Shannon and his wife Joan were spending a quiet evening in. It was a hot, humid, and stormy summer night, and the two cuddled up on the couch watching a movie in their off-base home not far from Fort Bragg. After their movie wrapped up, they went to bed. At 3:07 a.m., the Fayetteville Police Department responded to a 911 call where a woman was saying that someone had shot her husband. The woman was so frantic on the phone that the 911 dispatcher had to tell her to repeat herself and to calm down several times. When the first responders arrived on scene, they found a very distraught Joan, and she pointed them in the direction of the master bedroom. Unfortunately, when they arrived, it was too late and there was nothing that they could do to save David. Immediately, the investigators knew by just looking at David and the scene that this was intentional. This wasn't a random accidental shooting. This was obviously a hit, and someone had walked into that bedroom, placed a gun against David's head and shot, and then placed the gun against his chest and shot again. Now, when they asked Joan about what happened, she claimed that something startled her awake, and when she woke up, her ears were ringing, and then she heard another shot. She believes that whatever woke her up was likely the first shot, quickly followed by a second one. Joan said that when she realized what was happening, she jumped out of bed and turned the light on to find her husband dying. She claims that she never got a look at the person, but more so had a feeling of them leaving the room before she sprang out of bed. Joan describes this as more of a shadow that she saw leaving the room. After getting up and seeing David dying, she attempted to follow the person out of the bedroom because she was worried for the safety of her children in other parts of the home. When she didn't see anyone, Joan rushed back into the bedroom and made that 911 call. Now, on that night, Joan's oldest daughter, Daisy, was out of town, but in the home, fast asleep, was her and David's two sons that were 8 and 10 years old at that time. And her daughter, Elizabeth, who was 15, was in the house as well. On that night, Elizabeth had a friend staying over, and that friend is Vera Thompson, also 15 years old. The two boys slept through the whole thing, and according to Elizabeth, she and Vera had stayed up hanging out all night, talking and listening to music before they fell asleep. When they were questioned, they stated that they hadn't seen anything when they woke up from all of the commotion. So, obviously, the authorities secure the house and they begin the search of the home, which this wasn't going to be an easy task. The house was a complete mess, and I don't mean in the sense of the intruder came in and ransacked it. I mean, literally, the house was a disaster. There was so much clutter everywhere. Boxes upon boxes in random corners. There were baskets and piles of clothing all over the floor. The kitchen had dishes in the sink with food all over the counters. It was filthy. The bathroom was also very filthy. Joan and David's bedroom was also a cluttered mess. This made finding any kind of evidence like looking for a needle in a haystack. Slowly but surely, the cops combed their way through the house, and they found zero evidence. They found no fingerprints that didn't belong to anyone within the home, no footprints, no forced entry, and no usable DNA. They did, however, find lying on the floor next to the bed where David's lifeless body lay, two unspent bullets from a 9mm gun. When asked if there were any weapons in the house, Joan did admit that David did have several guns and plenty of ammo within the home. But she was unsure of where those two live bullets came from or why they would be there. Once more, the authorities attempted to get any kind of details about this mystery shadow person that came in and killed her husband. But Joan couldn't give a single detail about this person. So the authorities had nothing to go off of. One thing, though, that the investigators were really hung up on was the fact that there appeared to be no forced entry. But on top of no forced entry, there had been no wet or muddy footprints. As I mentioned earlier, the night was a stormy night. It had been raining pretty hard, and so the fact that there was zero signs that someone had come inside the home from outside on such a wet night really didn't sit well with the investigators. One other thing that really took the authorities by surprise was what they found stashed inside of the master bedroom closet. When searching for evidence, they uncovered dozens upon dozens of pornographic magazines. They found stacks of porn videos and a whole arsenal of sex toys. Now, to each their own, of course, but when they asked Joan about the items, she was very upfront and very open about the fact that her and David were swingers. I think most people are familiar with the term swingers, but in case you're not, a swinger is a person who engages in group sex or they swap sexual partners with someone else. Joan told the authorities that she and David were very active within the swingers community in Fayetteville, and they would often attend parties to couple swap. They also were a part of a forum board online where they would meet other people on the internet and make plans to meet up for sex. According to Joan, they were meeting up with people for sex up to four times a week. Obviously, being a part of this community isn't illegal and is actually a lot more common than I think people realize. And I just want to say, if it's not clear, I am not knocking those who participate in the swingers lifestyle. I don't want to give off that impression at all. Like I said, to each their own, I really don't care. It's not my business. However, the authorities thought that this was something that they really needed to look into. Bringing other people into your marital bed can cause some serious issues. We've seen it in plenty other cases. Even though they both are willing participants in engaging in these activities, you truly never know if something could have gone south with one of those situations with somebody that they met. So this opened up a whole new set of leads that the investigators had to follow. While the authorities began following those leads that the swinger lifestyle presented them, they also questioned David's family in North Dakota, and they asked them if they could think of anyone that would want David hurt. They couldn't think of a single person who would want to harm him, and they were convinced that David's job within the special forces in the Army was likely what got him killed. His mother recalls in an interview thinking that David must have uncovered something he shouldn't have and he was killed because of it. While looking into their swinger lifestyle, the investigators learned that David and Shannon had been very active within this community for years, long before they moved to North Carolina. According to Joan, the moment that their family was relocated to North Carolina, David was logging into the internet trying to find new swingers clubs for them to join, And lo and behold, there is a significant amount of clubs in Fayetteville, North Carolina. So they had lots of opportunities to meet new people within their lifestyle. The main group that it seemed like they utilized was one that not only had couples willing to swap partners, but also people who were individuals and not with a partner. These forum boards online would be a place to chat and find parties that they could attend, and they could also utilize it almost as an advertisement. David would go on there and list information about him and his wife, things that they liked sexually, what they were willing to do and try, and then other people could reply back on there stating their interests. These websites were also utilized to list different parties or gatherings happening at various places. And from what I've learned is that often they would happen at hotels. Whoever organized these meetups would book two adjoining hotel rooms. One side was used to mingle, drink, and find people who you were interested in swapping partners with or people that you were interested in having sex with. Once they got to know each other a little bit and find their match, if you will, they would then move over to the other room and find a spot to begin their sexual activity. Meanwhile, there are other random people throughout this second room also engaging in sex. In the Dateline episode on this case, Keith Morrison asked Joan how this lifestyle affected their marriage, and Joan stated that she felt like this lifestyle actually improved their marriage. She claims that many marriages fall apart because of cheating, but with swinging, there is no betrayal or lies. It's very open, it's very honest, and she says that she doesn't associate sex and love together. Both her and David just really liked sex, and they wanted to have lots of it. And I guess they also wanted to experience sex with other people outside of their marriage. Usually, David and Joan would meet people at hotels, but sometimes they would bring them back to the house as well. They never wanted the kids to know what they were doing, so they would get them to leave the house for the weekend and stay at a friend's house. But when the kids would come home, they would always find it odd that their bedroom furniture had been rearranged. And it wasn't long before their teenage daughters started to catch on to what was going on when they would leave the home. The authorities asked Joan to create a list for them of people that she could think of that they had been romantically involved with within the swinger lifestyle. They also asked her to provide them with any names of people that maybe she had been one-on-one involved with that maybe David did or didn't know about. This is when Joan gave the name of Jeffrey Wilson. Now, Jeffrey was also a soldier at Fort Bragg, and David first met him online when Jeffrey was using the name of Black Stuntman on the Swingers online groups. David and Jeffrey began chatting online and discussing the swinger lifestyle, and it was David who told Jeffrey that he really needed to meet his wife, Joan. The three ended up meeting up at a hotel room where they sat down strictly to talk and get to know each other. There wasn't anything sexual about this meeting, and it was purely just to meet and get acquainted. Shortly after this first initial meeting, the three met up again at one of those big swinger parties, and that was when they first initially engaged in sexual activities. After this first sexual interaction, Joan and Jeffrey continued to see each other. Apparently, Joan and David had created rules and boundaries with each other for their swinger lifestyle. And within those rules, they had decided that they could each see people privately as long as the other spouse was aware, and that no romantic feelings blossomed, and it was strictly about meeting up for sex. So David was totally fine with Joan getting together with Jeffrey. Jeffrey himself was actually married with children, but it is believed that at the time of David's murder, she was not aware of her husband's extracurricular activities. Jeffrey was one of the individuals on the Swingers website that was alone when he came to the parties and didn't have a spouse or partner that participated with him. Eventually, whatever you want to call this thing between Joan and Jeffrey turned into a friendship, and it wasn't long after that that Joan had Jeffrey over at the house and she introduced him to her children. It would later come out that according to both Joan's teenage daughters and according to Jeffrey himself, Joan fell in love with Jeffrey. This is something that Joan has always completely denied in interviews. She claims that they were always just friends and sexual partners, and that no romantic lovey-dovey feelings ever grew. When Joan presented the name of Jeffrey Wilson to the authorities as someone she was involved with, they knew that they had to hunt him down for questioning. Could he be a jealous lover that took matters into his own hands? It wasn't hard to find Jeffrey. As I mentioned, he also was a soldier on Fort Bragg. And when they sat him down for questioning, he admitted that he was having an affair that his wife didn't know about with Joan. He said that they had been seeing each other for sex for about 4 months. In the beginning, they were meeting up for sex twice a week, but in July, when David was murdered, they were meeting up to 4 times a week. Jeffrey didn't hold back anything when talking to the investigators, and he spilled his guts about the fact that Joan was very open about the fact that she didn't want to be married to David any longer. Jeffrey claimed that Joan had professed her love to him and that she wanted to be with him. Jeffrey said that she was saying that she didn't love her husband anymore and that she wanted to leave him, but she financially couldn't afford to do so. According to Jeffrey, he told Joan that he was really only in this relationship or whatever you want to call it for sex and that he didn't want to run off with her. Despite him telling her that he just wanted sex, she kept pushing and pushing for more with Jeffrey. He said that around July 18th, 5 days before the murder, Joan came to Jeffrey and told him that she couldn't take it anymore, that she wanted to be with him. It also came out during this interview that David had started to catch on to Joan's feelings for Jeffrey, which broke their rules that they had in place. He told her that she could no longer see Jeffrey, but she went ahead and did it anyway. David was murdered on a Tuesday morning. The Sunday before that, Joan had met up with Jeffrey for sex, despite her husband demanding that she break things off. When asked where he was on the night of July 22nd and the early morning hours of July 23rd, Jeffrey had a solid alibi. He had been working that night on Fort Bragg, and his alibi checked out. He was there all night long. When Keith Morrison asked Joan why Jeffrey thought that she was in love with him, she kind of hesitated before saying pretty aggressively that he was self-centered and thought that the whole world was in love with him. But she, in fact, was not. And according to her, the thing that they had going on between them was actually coming to an end, and they had already started to pull apart. Things with Joan's story really wasn't adding up. The authorities felt like her story about this shadowy figure sneaking into her bedroom and killing her husband seemed really far-fetched. There were 0 signs of forced entry, no signs of anyone had come into the house at all from the outside. It seemed like Joan was in this one-sided love affair. And come to find out, Joan was due to receive a $700,000 payout for David's life insurance. So they pretty much told her, "We don't believe you." Joan immediately got defensive and claims that the lead investigator on the case is prejudiced against her and that her lifestyle choices are causing the investigators to judge her and blame her without proof. She felt like because of her life choices and the fact that she was participating in the swingers' lifestyle made them not want to dig any deeper and look at any other possible leads, and that they were hyper-focused on her. Obviously, during all of the investigation, David's family back in North Dakota were kept in the loop, and they were absolutely stunned and shocked to learn all of the private and intimate details of David and Joan's sex life. They had no idea that they were a part of this lifestyle, and when they learned that Joan was a suspect in his murder, they were speechless. They told the authorities that there was no way that Joan would ever do anything to David, and that she loved him and always cared for him. His family didn't believe that Joan was capable of such a thing, and they told the investigators that they could see Elizabeth, Joan's teenage daughter, doing something to harm her stepfather. According to David's sister, Brenda, Elizabeth was extremely violent. She and her sister, Daisy, as I mentioned earlier, were completely troubled teens. Brenda said that when they turned into teenagers, it was all about boys, drugs, and violence. Anytime that Elizabeth got angry with someone, she made sure to destroy something of theirs. Elizabeth admitted that she was a rebellious teenager, but placed the blame of a hostile home life on the adults. Joan also admits that when it came to Elizabeth, she was done with her. She ran out of ideas and ways to try and get her daughter to behave and to get her back on track. And when nothing worked, she kind of just gave up on her and she left the parenting to David. Since David was in the military, he was very strict with things and had high standards. Whenever Elizabeth would break rules, he would punish her and ground her. Instead of following the rules of her grounding, she would sneak out of her room. It got to the point that she was sneaking out so much that they had to install alarms on her bedroom window and door just so they knew if she tried to sneak out. But that didn't stop her. She did it anyways. She was clearly showing that no matter what rules David tried to enforce, she wouldn't follow them. Just 2 weeks before his murder, David had even called home to his mom back in North Dakota to ask her for advice on how to handle Elizabeth. He also was at his wit's end and didn't know what else he could do to get her to behave. It was during this conversation that David's mom asked him flat out, "Do you think she is capable of doing something violent?" And he replied with, "I don't know." Not only was David's family telling the authorities that they thought Elizabeth was responsible, tips started to trickle into the Fayetteville Police Department from anonymous callers stating that Elizabeth was bragging about the homicide. And her friend Vera Thompson, who had stayed the night at the Shannon residence that night, had also been talking about the murder to people. Police brought Vera in for questioning and really put the lean on her, and she cracked. She became extremely emotional, saying that she didn't want to tell on anyone, but she was clearly ready to get it off of her chest because she finally dished all of the details. Vera told the investigators that Elizabeth was her very best friend and that the two of them shared everything. She said that Elizabeth told her that Elizabeth and her mother, Joan, had discussions about killing David Shannon. She said that Elizabeth told her that Joan had actually attempted to kill David by poisoning him. And she said that Elizabeth and Joan had conspired to kill David on the early morning hours of July 23rd, and that it was Elizabeth who pulled the trigger for her mother. Vera said that 2 days before the murder, she and Elizabeth went to an open field where Elizabeth practiced shooting the gun that was used to kill David. She wanted to know what to expect when she fired the gun at him. The authorities were able to find bullet casings out at this field that matched those found at the crime scene. When asked about what happened to the gun after Elizabeth shot David, Vera said that a man by the name of D. Humphrey was waiting in the neighborhood to take the gun from Elizabeth so that he could dispose of it. D. Humphrey was also brought in for questioning, and he admitted to the same story that Vera told. On July 30th, 2002, just 1 week after the murder of David Shannon, his wife, Joan Shannon, was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. When she was arrested, she had been with David's family, who happened to be in town for his funeral. They were absolutely shocked as the police slapped handcuffs on Joan. Meanwhile, Joan kept demanding that she was innocent. It took a couple of days before the police were able to track down 15-year-old Elizabeth Shannon. And according to an Oxygen.com article, when they found her, they found her hiding under a bed in a trailer that was owned by one of her friends. She also was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. When they took Elizabeth into custody, they brought her in for questioning and questioned her for 2 hours. Elizabeth confessed everything. She claimed that she did it for her mother and that her mother had wanted David dead for months. She told the story how Joan unsuccessfully tried to poison him. She admitted that Joan had tried to recruit one of her friends to kill David. And finally, when she couldn't get anyone else to do it, Joan asked Elizabeth if she would be brave enough to kill her stepfather. When asked why she did it, she admitted that she really never felt loved by her mom. She said that love and affection wasn't really given in the Shannon household, and it was something that she always desired. She had always desired to feel loved by her mother and to have that strong mother-daughter bond. When listening to Elizabeth talk about it, it really seems like she just needed to feel loved by her mom and that she was seeking her mother's approval. A few months prior to the murder, Joan really started acting more loving towards Elizabeth. She took her shopping, they went on different outings together, and she was showering her with attention. Authorities believe that this was Joan's way of buttering Elizabeth up to get her to finally cave and do this awful deed for her. Elizabeth talks in the Dateline episode about how it felt having her mom constantly in her ear asking her to do this, and how she just wanted to do it and get it over with so that she could please her mother, and so that nothing would change between them now that they were spending time together. Elizabeth told authorities that she had pre-arranged for a way to get rid of the gun, and on that night she had used one of David's guns to kill him. The prosecutors offered Elizabeth a deal in exchange for her testifying against her mother. She agreed, and instead of receiving life in prison without the possibility of parole, Elizabeth Shannon received 25 to 31 years in prison. The prosecutors also offered Joan a plea deal, saying that they would give her 25 to 31 years in prison in exchange for a guilty plea. And she flat out refused, stating that she wasn't going to plead guilty to something that she didn't do or was a part of. On August 15, 2005, Joan's murder trial began. The prosecution put many witnesses on the stand, but they saved their star witness for last. While Elizabeth Shannon testified, Joan refused to look at her. After hearing all of the details, the jury deliberated for only a day and a half before they came back with a guilty verdict. she was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. To this day, Joan maintains that she is innocent, and standing beside her in support of her is David's mother and sister. They believe that the jury got it wrong. Joan and David's family all state that Elizabeth is a liar and will do anything that she can to take others down with her. They said that any time that Elizabeth got caught doing something, she would always attempt to shift blame to others, even if she was caught red-handed in the act. They claim that she is very manipulative and good at getting people to believe her lies. Both women are serving their sentences in two different prisons in North Carolina, but Dateline gave them the opportunity to say something to each other in the episode. Joan told her daughter that she loved her, that she wished that she had been a better mother to her, and that their situation is hard on both of them. When asked if Elizabeth wanted to say anything, she declined, stating that nothing she will say to her mother will change the person that her mother is. That nothing she will say will make her mom finally admit that she has been lying to everyone and admit that she was involved in David's murder. David and Joan's two young boys were taken in by David's family in North Dakota and have been very well taken care of. They also believe that their mother is innocent and have made several trips to visit her in prison. They also continue to have a relationship with her over the telephone, but have never spoken to their sister again. Joan Shannon is now in her mid-50s, serving her life sentence at the Southern Correctional Institute in Troy, North Carolina. And Elizabeth is being housed at the North Carolina Correctional Institution for Women just outside of Raleigh. She is now in her mid-30s, and her earliest possible release date is in another 5 years, in 2029. At that time, she will be 42 years old. Though Elizabeth is behind bars, she has not changed her behavior. And according to Oxygen.com, she has racked up over 30 different offenses, ranging from theft and fighting to sexual acts. I am very curious to hear your guys' thoughts on this case. Do you think Joan is innocent, and do you agree that the authorities easily pinned this on her after they learned about the swinger lifestyle? Or do you believe Elizabeth's story that her mother wanted David dead? Make sure that you guys are a part of my private Facebook group so that I can hear your thoughts and opinions. You can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group on Facebook. In there, I share all pictures and information pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. You can also let me know your thoughts and opinions over on my post about this case on Instagram at Crimeaholly. I truly cannot wait to hear what you guys are thinking about this one. That is all for this week's episode. Until next time, be aware and take care. Bye-bye.